From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it is Labor Day. We hope you're working if you want to be. You aren't if you don't. In Florida and in parts of the East Coast, people aren't having much of a choice today. Barbecues have been put off, work sometimes put on hold as people track Hurricane Dorian, now a Category 4 storm, still parked over the Bahamas. We're hearing reports of terrible damage there and at least one death, an 8-year-old who drowned, his sister still missing. And Dorian is slowly headed for Florida. Earlier today, Florida's Governor Rick DeSantis told Floridians not to let their guard down.
This has been frustrating, I know, for a lot of people, because this seems like we've been talking about this for a long time. But we are in a situation where the storm is stalling very close to our coast, and the movement that it makes is going to have a lot of impact on Floridians.
And Georgia and the Carolinas are also bracing. Ray Hawthorne is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Ray, you guys work so hard at times like this. What's the most important thing you want us to know about Dorian right now?
Well, Dorian right now is still moving very, very slowly. It has not yet started to make that turn toward the north that we have been anticipating. We do expect that to happen a little bit later on today or tonight. The storm is still a Category 4 hurricane. Maximum sustained winds are near 155 miles per hour. And a lot of us here in Florida have been waiting with bated breath for that northward turn. We still anticipate that to happen a little bit later, but it hasn't happened just yet.
Well, and remind us, we know because of climate change that waters are warmer. Does this mean that a storm like Dorian is hovering longer over warmer waters and maybe hoovering that water up?
Well, it's a fairly complex subject there. So warm water is certainly a part of what hurricanes require to intensify. The other part of that is wind shear in the atmosphere. And the wind shear typically has to be on the lighter side. So it's really hard to say with any certainty just how much of an impact climate change is having. But certainly that is a consideration that's under heavy research.
We'll take that out of the equation. I mean, these are warmer waters anyway. They're off Florida. So does that slow moving for you as a meteorologist, does that, you know, set off an alarm? If it's moving slow, does that mean more rain or no? What does it mean?
Yeah, what it means essentially is that there's likely to be more in the way of heavy wave action. Coastal flooding is going to be a major concern. We have had sea level rise, of course, over the last several decades. And so that this can certainly exacerbate that. And that very slow motion is due primarily to the fact that there is hardly anything steering the hurricane at all. We did have a ridge of high pressure north of the hurricane steering it the last couple of days, but that ridge has weakened. And so there's really nothing for the hurricane to be pushed along by. So we're waiting for that next mechanism, and that should come in tonight into the day Tuesday.
Well, it is anyway. It's like trying to pin down a whirling dervish. You know, it's an act of nature. But even with that, do you have a sense, you know, of when it might hit Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and whether or not there's going to be, as we're hearing reports from the National Hurricane Center, a tornado involved in this?
Yeah, so it looks like the current forecast track is keeping the core of the hurricane most likely offshore, somewhere around 70, 80 miles, somewhere around that amount. But that is still close enough, Robin, to bring tropical storm force winds pretty easily onto the east coast of Florida, mainly from the Treasure Coast all the way up to the first coast coming up. That looks like it'll start to arrive later this afternoon. I've been looking at some of the observations down there, and winds are getting close to tropical storm force in parts of Southeast Florida. We expect that trend to ramp up later on this afternoon and tonight. And if the storm gets just even a few miles closer, we have such little room for error here. There certainly could be hurricane force winds, hurricane force wind gusts getting onshore. And I'll tell you what, Robin, this is not likely to get out of the way along the east coast of Florida until perhaps later on Wednesday. And it's Monday afternoon right now, so not a fast mover.
And Ray, in the 30 seconds we have, for people saying, oh, it went from a 5 to a 4. And it went from that tight eye that we saw earlier this morning to a wider eye, you know, maybe spreading it out more. For those who think that's meaning not to be worried, you say what?
Oh, gosh, there's hardly a difference between a Category 4 and a Category 5 hurricane. It's maybe the difference between, like, being hit by an 18-wheeler and a train. There's really not a huge difference there. Okay. The impacts will be much the same to Florida and the Carolinas over the coming days.
Ray Hawthorne, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He's going to be updating us over the day, watching Hurricane Dorian on this Labor Day. Ray, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
And now to Texas, where the cities of Odessa and Midland are reeling after a gunman drove through both on Saturday, killing 7 people, injuring over 20. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales is here. And Carlos, we spoke to you during the El Paso shooting. Now, this one, terrible stories. We know the shooter was pulled over by police for failing to signal. He fired on them. A young woman on the phone with her sister heard her sister scream as the shooter killed her and then took her truck. Talk about how this was different than a shooting that happens in one space. People didn't know where the shooter was going next.
That's right. I think for a lot of the people in Odessa, they heard ambulances, ringing out through, and they didn't know where the person would be, or where the shots were coming from. The gunman was in one vehicle, and as you mentioned, he hijacked a United States Postal Service mail carrier van, and then so people thought there were multiple shooters at one point, which police have cleared up that there is just the one gunman. And people didn't know where he was going to be. You know, you had people that were shot while waiting at a stoplight, mm-hmm. others whose cars were struck that were parked in kind of like a shopping center where there's a Walmart, Home Depot, and just kind of other places that you would go to on, any given Saturday to kind of do your shopping and all that.
We are not naming the gunman, but we know others are speaking of him, including a neighbor who said that she called police because he would sit on his roof and shoot at her pets in her backyard. Apparently, the police couldn't find her address on GPS. But the point is that people knew things about him that might have raised alarms. What else do we know about him?
Well, he's 36 years old. He was a white male. And just last night, the New York Times reported that the shooting began hours after he was fired from his trucking job, born in Texas. Haven't heard much else as far as kind of alarms that might have been raised beforehand, but we know those details at the moment.
Yeah. What are people there doing now? We know there was a 17-month-old toddler who underwent surgery for wounds to her mouth. Her teeth were shot out, but we understand she's home playing mm-hmm. with her twin, Grace, there. But what else do we know about how severely wounded others are, and how are people starting, though in shock, we understand they're starting to mourn.
Yeah, they are starting to mourn. Just last night, just over a day after, this terrible tragedy unfolded in our West Texas community, people came together at a local university for a prayer vigil, and it was an hour of prayer, of people just coming together and really, in the open, just grieving. And I think for a lot of people that were there, it was really a first step toward healing, toward that process of finding that sense of normalcy. There were several people there who spoke to our reporter on the ground at the vigil, and they told them that following the shooting, they did not want to leave their house. They were scared and terrified to go outdoors. But when they heard about the vigil, they knew they had to be there. And that's what started to bring people out. So I think last night at this vigil, it really was a space for people of the Permian Basin, of both Odessa and Midland, these sister cities that are about a 15-minute drive from each other, to come together and really unite and begin the healing process.
That's why you're seeing the T-shirts, Permian Basin Strong. Mm-hmm. But this shooting comes after the one in El Paso, 22 people killed there. Texas is loosening some gun restrictions, as this is happening. And your governor, Greg Abbott, made an impassioned plea at a press conference saying something has to be done. Yet others are pointing out, in 2015, when reports showed that California passed Texas in gun purchases, he tweeted out something to Texas residents to the effect of, hey, let's take back our lead. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. So people are pointing fingers at him. This is a gun state, and yet nobody was able to stop this shooter until the police rammed him with a special car. What is the gun conversation around this?
Well, at the beginning of our conversation, we talked about El Paso. And following the tragedy in El Paso at that Walmart, a lot of the El Paso Democratic delegation, the state lawmakers, they came together and they were really urging Texas Governor Greg Abbott to push for a special session to bring lawmakers back to the state capitol and figure out a solution to gun violence in the state. At that time, Abbott, you know, told press and those elected officials that were kind of imploring him to make this move, he told them that there wasn't a need for a special session to do this. And what he did was he followed through with a series of roundtable discussions, which are happening across the state. Just one, oh, maybe a week ago, or just actually maybe this past Friday in El Paso, to have these conversations about what can be done. I'll be interested to see now what happens given this weekend's shooting. I think the pressure is going to be on to call for a special session. And I think some of the state lawmakers that represent Odessa and Midland think it could be a possibility.
Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The Emmys are in about 2 weeks, up for 7 awards more than any other documentary is National Geographic's Free Solo, which has already won an Oscar for Best Documentary and which had me and maybe you sweating buckets, watching through fingers, even though we knew the ending. Free Solo follows climber Alex Honnold as he becomes the first person to climb Yosemite National Park's over 3,000-foot rock mountain El Capitan, with no ropes to catch him should he fall. Filmmakers Jimmy Chin and his wife Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli filmed Alex with a team of cameraman climbers on ropes, all aware that one little mistake from them could kill him. He clings to the tiniest crevices, at one point debating whether to swing one leg out to get a toehold on a ledge or jump sideways.
In some ways, it makes more sense to do the big two-handed jump because you're jumping to a good edge, so there's actually something to catch. But the idea of jumping without a rope seems completely outrageous. If you miss it, that's that.
That's that. We spoke with Alex Honnold and filmmaker Jimmy Chin last February. And Jimmy, I want to start with you because, you know, as we see, while Alex is training for this climb, this is a film that we're discussing, the climb, of course, first and foremost, but you filmed it. And you and your wife were very conflicted about that. Explain why.
Well, I think the main question for us was whether or not us being there filming him would make it more dangerous or more likely for him to fall.
Yeah. I used to work a lot with cameras, and you said you were conscious of something called Kodak courage, people who will do something because the camera's there they wouldn't maybe ordinarily do.
Yes. That was one of the central questions that Chai and I had to answer for ourselves, was whether or not we trusted Alex's decision-making process and how he would approach the climb and whether or not the external pressure of a production would push him to do something that he wouldn't normally do.
Or whether I see you've said somewhere, even, you know, dropping a lens cap.
Yes. Being that the climbing is very tenuous, I mean, if you knocked off a pebble even, you know, it could actually fall 200 feet and hit him just at the wrong moment. You know, there were a lot of different scenarios that we thought about and tried to kind of imagine all the different outcomes in order to mitigate the risk.
Yeah. I think it's maybe worth adding that overall the production probably made it slightly safer for me just because, I mean, we're talking about Kodak courage. In a lot of ways, I experienced the opposite because I was up there with my friends working on it so long. Because there were people watching me, I wound up preparing more for the climb than I'd maybe expected.
Because on your end, Alex, you didn't want to put them in the position. I mean, I can't even, this is so hard to even say. You'd be dying right in front of them.
Yeah, I certainly was trying to avoid that, but but even more so, I was just trying to do my due diligence to some extent. You know, I mean, the crew was putting so much effort into crafting a great film, and so I was trying to do my share. You know, I was trying to make sure that I put in the amount of effort as well.
Yeah. And just to back to that thought, not that I want to belabor it, but, you know, too late, I probably already have, but Jimmy, you know, as you said, you would see him go through the frame.
Yes. I think over the course of 2 years of production, I think I woke up every morning thinking about the worst case scenario. That sounds really morbid, but I mean, it also is a useful tool to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Surely you didn't think about it every day. I mean, because I certainly thought about worst case scenarios as well, but not every day. I mean, it has to be a balance of best case scenarios.
It was weird.
Worst case
it was
scenarios.
Every day when I woke up in the morning, I had like this.
Well, no wonder
you know,
it all seems
pressure.
So stressful for you.
Alex, now do you feel bad?
Yeah, now I feel bad for sure.
Well, let's talk about what we're talking about. We've set the stakes here. But Alex, free soloing, seeming to pull yourself up. Your upper body strength is amazing. Your fingers are amazingly strong. What's the appeal?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that because I think what's often lost is the joy of it. You know, the sheer joy in the movement and how you know, almost playful it can be to climb a wall of that size and scale unencumbered. I mean, it does feel quite beautiful. And I think that at the heart, I've always loved the movement of climbing. And free soloing is, you know, in some ways the purest way that you can rock climb.
Yeah.
And so I spend a lot of time talking about the consequences, you know, facing death, those kinds of things. And those are natural questions. But I think actually the joy of it is why I free solo.
Because it's not like you're not looking, you're seeing where you are. This context of, you know, you're in the air. There are points on the mountain when it's just friction, there's some kind of friction between maybe a toe and the wall or a thumb and the wall. What does that feel like?
I mean, it feels incredible. I think you were just kind of touching on it. I mean, to be surrounded by air, to be in the void but still feel in control personally, you know, to take a situation that should be terrifying but then to feel comfortable, you know, through preparation, through hard work, through, I guess, self-mastery to some extent. You know, I mean, it feels incredible.
We learn a lot in the film about how you in particular may be more able to do this than the average bear because you have a special brain, apparently, where, you do, where it's been tested and your amygdala doesn't really fire the way other brains do. That's the kind of the...
But I actually don't think that that's a unique feature. I think that's the result of 10 years of exposure in this space. I mean, basically, by having spent so much time free soloing, putting myself into these positions, I think I've sort of desensitized my amygdala to certain types of stimulus.
And let's explain, because it doesn't fire up. So you're saying I had the chicken and the egg wrong. You're saying
exactly.
It's a result of...
Exactly.
So it doesn't fire up the way ours might when we get frightened or we're thinking we're not going to survive. Yours has toned down.
Exactly. I think that the level of stimulus in the test that I underwent is just not sufficient after having spent my whole life free soloing on big walls. You know, and it's hard to say what comes first, chicken or egg. I mean, maybe that's why I've loved free soloing so much my whole life is maybe, you know, I am slightly duller in that response than average.
Is that, I mean, I'm wondering, you know, this idea that you're not frightened.
Well, no. So on the actual day of the climb, I wasn't particularly frightened. Though, I mean, I was still certainly nervous walking up to the base because it's still a pretty intimidating wall. It's very, very large.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I was very frightened for the many years ahead of time. And that's why I put so much preparation into it. That's why it was something that I dreamt about for so long and didn't actually do. Huh. And it wasn't until I spent 2 years working on it that it actually became a possibility.
Well, this is something that really impacted a lot of the people that I was with who are athletes in different ways. Every single inch of that climb, you had planned ahead and done over and over and over again on ropes.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's what I felt like I needed to feel comfortable up there.
Yeah. Jimmy Chin, talk about the planning that you had to do.
There was a tremendous amount of planning and choreography in terms of shooting Alex on the wall. And, you know, over the course of 2 years while he's practicing, we're essentially also practicing how we're going to shoot it. So logistically, you know, there is a lot of matters that we had to deal with. It's a 3,000-foot wall. There's certain sections that are 1,000 feet down the wall, and you need to get a camera person 1,000 feet down the wall. Mm. You know, they're carrying all their camera equipment. They're building their cameras on the wall. It's a pretty significant physical task. We also wanted to make sure that on the day of the climb, there weren't a whole lot of decisions to be made. So we practiced shooting and figured out exactly how we wanted to shoot each section that was, you know, important to the narrative. Mm. But in terms of the producing, I think that the real challenge was kind of insulating Alex from the pressures of the production.
I want to talk about one other aspect of the film. Jimmy, your wife, Elizabeth Chai, not a climber, she was interested in the effect, Alex, that your climb had on a new girlfriend. So your relationship with her becomes a thread in this film. And there's a moment where she asks you if you would ever take her into consideration when approaching a climb. Let's listen.
Would putting me into the equation actually ever change anything? Would you actually make decisions differently?
if I had some kind of obligation to maximize my lifespan, then, like, yeah, obviously I'd have to give up soloing.
Was me asking you, do you see that as an obligation now?
No. No.
Oh.
Yes, Asani's not going to be thrilled that that's the clip, but I mean, we had many conversations like that. I mean, it's hard to, we're still dating, and it's, we're 3 years into this great relationship, but, we were in this new relationship, and free soloing El Cap is something that I'd been dreaming about for so many years that it just meant so much more to me than, a new girlfriend's opinion, but clearly that balance changes over time.
Right. Alex, El Capitan, behind you, are you done?
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. No, I mean, I'm certainly not done climbing. I'll climb my whole life. I love climbing.
But I mean, that kind of climbing, not just free solo, but the impossible.
I don't know. Honestly, El Capitan has just meant so much to me for so long. It was worth it. We'll see if anything else ever captures the imagination for me in quite the same way.
Yeah. And again, Jimmy Chin, I'm just wondering, part of the film I love is when one of the cameramen, who I have such an affection for you, Alex, they all do, he turns around. He can't look through his viewfinder. He can't see a particularly difficult passage. He can't watch.
Yes.
And Jimmy Chin, I'm wondering, how about you? Were there parts where you just could not watch?
There weren't, because the directive I gave to the entire team, and which I felt like I needed to live up to, was that you needed to stay focused on the task at hand. That was for the wall team. It was okay for Mikey to turn away because he was filming on the ground.
Yeah, and in some ways, I mean, Mikey had to watch the entire 4 hours of the ascent, whereas the crew on the wall, I would climb past him for a few minutes at a time.
Yeah.
But Mikey watched the whole thing, which is why he was horrified by the end.
Yeah, he couldn't handle it.
He was a wreck. But by the way, that reminds me, I did want more. Will we ever see that four-hour climb?
I hope so. That's what I want to see.
People have asked about it. Maybe someday. Maybe someday.
That's filmmaker Jimmy Chin, along with his wife, Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli. He directed Free Solo, about Alex Honnold, the first person to free solo climb El Capitan in Yosemite's National Park. We spoke last February. By the way, we still can't see that four-hour climb. I'm not sure if I could watch the whole thing. And Free Solo is up for 7 Emmy Awards on September 14th. Reported a lot of stories about immigration and deportation, but this next one hasn't been in the headlines as much. It's about Keith Byrne, who is not the face of immigration enforcement you see on TV news. The 37-year-old from Ireland was picked up by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement this summer after leaving his Philadelphia area home for work. As Laura Benchoff of member station WHYY reports, Byrne's case puts a spotlight on the small but growing number of Irish immigrants facing deportation in recent years.
Keith Byrne is from County Cork, Ireland, and has been trying to get a green card for nearly 10 years. His wife, Karen, says they've always been out in the open. There's a sign on the front door of their suburban home that says welcome in Gaelic. And out back...
Did you see the Irish flag coming down 309? Because you can... Or down Paper Mill? Did you come down this way?
We did come down Paper Mill, but I didn't...
We have a huge notice. Irish flag that you can see when the wind is blowing.
Karen, a U.S. citizen, says though his applications were rejected time after time, she was still shocked to find an immigration officer at her door one morning.
He had his keys and his phone, and he gave them to me, and he said he'll contact you shortly. He's going to be detained.
Byrne came to the United States in 2007 through what's called the Visa Waiver Program. It lets citizens from participating countries, mostly in Europe, visit the U.S. easily. But it makes it harder for them to get legal status if they break the rules. Keith overstayed. Then he met Karen. They got married in 2009 and are raising 3 kids. Because he'd applied for a green card, Byrne received work authorization and started a painting business. But his green card application was denied due to 2 small marijuana possession charges from when he lived in Ireland.
Ironically, they were able to get them the equivalent of expunged.
Wayne Sachs is an immigration attorney who has worked with the family.
But the expungement wouldn't be given full faith and credit in the United States.
Byrne's case shows both how easy it is to overstay a visa or visa waiver, as hundreds of thousands of people do each year, and how that can put families in a difficult position. Nicola Bell with the Irish Immigration Center of Philadelphia says it's hard to say just how many people from Ireland are in that situation.
Nobody actually knows. People don't tell you that they're undocumented, you know?
Official estimates put the number of unauthorized Irish immigrants in the United States anywhere from 10 to 50,000. In recent years, deportations of Irish immigrants, though tiny, have also ticked up from 30 a couple of years ago to nearly 50 last year. In a statement, an ICE spokesman said Byrne was arrested for, quote, failing to depart. After 2 weeks in detention, they released him on a judge's orders. His wife, Karen, says his arrest has forced them to confront a possibility they tried to ignore, that their life in the U.S. might not be permanent.
I guess you can be really naive when you really want something. I guess we just didn't think it would happen to us, or not even this soon. And we were still, like, in our minds, still working on that process. We weren't done.
Then the family got good news. The government agreed to let Byrne try again for a green card, sending him back to the beginning of a long application process. In the meantime, he has to check in with ICE. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Take a break from the news for a few minutes, please. Last year, Anna Cruz, a self-described housewife from Greenville, South Carolina, began to experience some uneasiness, maybe the same feeling some parents are feeling on this Labor Day, the traditional move-in day for college students. Anna's youngest child, Taylor, had been accepted to Clemson University. That's good. But Anna soon would be living in an empty nest.
And even though you know it's coming, right? I mean, the calendar pages keep flipping. It is something you can't anticipate how that's going to hit you. You just can't until you're in the middle of it, until you're experiencing it.
Well, then Taylor did leave home in August of 2018.
Your mind knows this is a positive milestone, but the profound emptiness, you know, it's just hard to describe. And so I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to do? What am I good at anymore?
Well, how about looking at something she was very good at 4 decades ago? Gary Wallach from NPR's Only a Game has this story.
In 1978, Anna Cruz was 21 years old. She worked as a word processing specialist in Maryland.
And was driving home from work one day and heard an ad on the radio for tryouts.
The NBA champion Washington Bullets were holding auditions for their dance team.
And I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go and try out.
Anna didn't have an extensive background in dance, but she went to the tryout anyway.
All the way there, and even when you get there, you're like, what the heck am I doing? Why am I here? What am I doing?
Anna says most of the other dancers were NFL or college cheerleaders. But she made the 1978-1979 Washington Bullets dance team.
All of it, you know, the friendships and the performances, even the practice. You know, it was all exciting.
Anna planned to try out for the Bullets the following season, but
in the fall of 79, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Very unexpected, very out of nowhere. It just was a little bit of an ordeal.
After a year of fighting, Anna beat the cancer. She returned to her job as a word processing specialist, but not to the Bullets. In the late 80s, she gave birth to a daughter, the first of her 3 kids.
My greatest joy, hands down, has been being a mom. So I just poured everything into that, you know, into the stuff at school, into, yeah, they can all come over, into this and that. So it would have been lunacy to me if I had thought about dancing, even as a hobby, or, you know, going to take a class or anything like that. It just wasn't even on my radar.
But that wasn't entirely true. Sometimes, when Anna watched dancers at an event or on TV, she'd remember how much she loved being one.
You know, maybe sit there and let my mind wander about knowing how that felt and how exciting it is. and betting I could still do that move.
The years flew by, and Anna's two oldest kids left their home in Greenville, South Carolina. Then, in March of 2018, the Washington Wizards held a 40th anniversary celebration of the franchise's only NBA title from back in the days when they were still the Bullets.
And so they invited all the players back and the coaches, and then any of the dancers through the years. I think there were about 60 of us, and we got to perform at this event. It sure reminded me of how enjoyable it was and the feeling you cannot describe, you know, while you're waiting there in the wings and you're waiting to go out there and perform.
Anna wanted to hold on to that feeling. Her youngest child was preparing to leave for Clemson University in the late summer, and that empty nest was looming.
And so I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to do? What am I good at anymore? Then this opportunity with the Wizards showed itself just absolutely out of nowhere.
In early September, about a month after her daughter left home, Anna got an email.
And boy, oh boy, it seemed like perfect timing to me.
The Wizards were holding tryouts for a new dance team, or perhaps a new older dance team. It was for dancers 50 and older and was sponsored by the AARP. It would be called the Wisdom.
God was saying, here, and here's an open door. Now, what are you going to do with it?
Her answer was to, in her words, get serious about my moves. She learned the latest hip-hop steps on YouTube. Her younger daughter taught her what she called booty pop. In late September of 2018, undeterred by the 8-hour drive from her home in Greenville, she tried out for the Wisdom.
Again, you know, I get there and I'm like, what am I doing? This is ridiculous. But it was my heart's desire to do this.
Anna had hardly danced over the previous 40 years. She says there were more than 80 dancers at the tryout, ranging in age from 50 to 76.
What's your dance experience?
Well, I was at the club last night, pretty good.
Absolute characters, totally uninhibited, you know, comfortable in their own skin, and just entertaining folks.
One, two, three, clap it four to the left. Five, six, seven to the back. Goes one.
Anna was told final decisions would be made in a couple days. She waited about a week and began to think she hadn't made the team. Then late one night, she got an email.
And I had just gotten home, and there it was. It was so exciting.
Anna Cruz had been chosen as one of the 20 members of the Wisdom Over 50 dance team. Her daughter, Taylor, happened to be home from Clemson for a visit.
And she was screaming and jumping up and down with me. And yeah, I didn't feel like a mom and a 60-year-old. I felt like a girl.
The Wisdom got just four practices in before their debut on November 24th, 2018.
Make some noise for the Wisdom!
The fans, so gracious, and the affirmation from them, and the excitement of the fans to this over 50, like, what are these women out there doing? When we came off the court that first game, I mean, these ladies were screaming and hugging.
Let's go. She just wanna pop, 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 pop.
Three of those women were on the Bullets with Anna 40 years ago. Another dancer, whose grandson is a member of the Wizards' regular dance team, is 76. One of them is a guy, and all of them have moves.
You know, to see these women in their 60s and 70s who are shaking their groove thing and doing like the Tootsie Roll and these dances, and just the sheer fun and the joy we're having, you know, like whoever's watching us or cheering us on is like, we're you.
For the record, Anna's husband, Michael, is completely supportive, but maybe not always for the right reasons.
Oh, he's gotten some mileage out of this, I don't mind telling you. He'll say, well, I told him my wife dances for the Washington Wizards, and they're like, what? How old are you? The guy has played that card more times than I care to think about.
The Wisdom danced at 10 games last season. Sometimes Anna stayed with friends or at a hotel so she wouldn't have to commute for a game on a Friday or Saturday and then again for practice on Sunday. And Anna realized something. Maybe the dreaded empty nest syndrome wasn't so dreadful after all. In fact, she says having no kids at home was the only way she could have chased her latest dream. And the whole experience gave her new confidence.
It makes you feel like, well, if I did that, I know I can do this, and I can do it. Like, here I am 61 years old, you know, but I have learned that I still have stuff to learn, right?
Anna will spend some time with Taylor when she's back from Clemson this summer. And this time, she's looking forward to the fall. She's going to try out for the Wisdom again.
You know, now that I've been bit by this bug, how can I not?
I hope you make the team next year if that's what you want. But if you don't make the team, what are you going to do to sort of fill that void?
Well, hello. I don't know if the Charlotte Hornets have an over 50 dance team, but I think they should.
They don't, but maybe soon. There are already about a dozen 50 and over squads dancing at NBA venues, and that number is likely to increase. For Anna and all the other dancers 50 and older, that sort of growth is good news. The opportunities it brings just never grow old. For Here and Now, I'm Gary Wallach.
Charlotte Hornets, take notice. And to see Anna Cruz and the Wisdom Dancers doing the Cabbage Patch and the Electric Slide, go to hereandnow.org. To Britain now, where this could be a momentous week, as if others haven't been. Tomorrow, Parliament returns to work after summer break. Last week, Prime Minister Boris Johnson got permission from the Queen to suspend their session, which will help Johnson, in office since July, take the UK out of the EU without a deal on October 31st, the deadline, without a lot of pushback from Parliament. There's also talk about Johnson calling a snap election. Let's bring in NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, there are members of Parliament, including in his own party, fighting Boris Johnson over this. But that's been outside the formal Parliament gathering. So remind us what it means that Johnson is suspending that session.
Well, what it means is that what Boris Johnson is trying to do is actually curtail the amount of time that Parliament has to meet and actually fight him before October 31st, when the country would crash out with a no-deal Brexit, without any withdrawal agreement with the European Union. And so they were going to go on recess anyway in the fall, but it's going to be a much tighter time frame for them. And they object to this because they feel that he's basically trying to sideline them, and that's why they're so upset. And on Tuesday, they'll be coming back, and we expect them to go after the prime minister on this.
Yeah, well, and he was only elected as prime minister by a handful of people because of the way the British election system is set up.
He was elected by his own party. So it was not a national election. So he does not have a sort of UK-wide electoral mandate.
And what might this snap general election mean?
Well, here's why Boris Johnson would want to do that. Right now, he has a razor-thin majority in Parliament, which is one reason why he's had trouble, and certainly Prime Minister Theresa May failed to get a Brexit deal through. What he may hope to do is, if Parliament blocks him this week, if they're able to pass legislation that prevents him from taking the UK out of the EU with no deal, what he could then do is call a snap election, and maybe next month run against Parliament and say, listen, the Parliament is trying to rob the people of the Brexit vote, and I just need a majority to get this through and bring people to the polls. He's a very charismatic guy. He's a good campaigner, and he may bet this is his way out of the Brexit conundrum that's paralyzed the politics of this country now for more than 3 years.
Yeah, but is that a guarantee?
No, it's not. Nothing, absolutely nothing is a guarantee, Robin, as we've discussed for quite some time. I think what's interesting is that right now the Conservatives are pretty – if you look at the most recent polls, I was just looking at them this morning, it looks like Conservatives could be in the aggregate in August about, let me see, 8 points ahead of Labor, the opposition Labor Party. So maybe he's figuring, if I do this – and the Labor Party is relatively weak because Jeremy Corbyn, the leader, is not popular. broadly speaking, in the United Kingdom, and he's a socialist. So Johnson could run against that and say, here's a guy who's going to nationalize, you know, different parts of the economy. Maybe Johnson thinks he has the margin he needs to do this. Now, of course, he could also end up losing his job.
Yeah, well,
the Tories could lose, and out he goes.
Well, and over the weekend, we heard from a lot of people who'd like to see that. Thousands of people protesting in London across the UK. What'd you hear from them?
Well, I think what they were coming in to London and other places, as you said, is they really object to what Johnson is doing with Parliament, trying to tighten the time frame they have to address Brexit. And I met a woman named Alison Carter. We were riding in on the train together to London, and she really objects to Prime Minister Johnson trying to push the country out without any withdrawal agreement, and really what she thinks without the say of the lawmakers here. Here's how she put it.
Completely against it, obviously. It's undemocratic. It just gives Parliament no time to stop it. Crashing out of the EU with a no deal would be horrendously bad.
And when she says horrendously bad, what she's talking about, Robin, is the nightmare scenario is suddenly you have customs posts up against the borders between the United Kingdom and the European Union, long what they call here in England tailbacks. We call them, you know, giant long lines of trucks trying to get through customs, and maybe even the worst case scenario, customs posts going up on the island of Ireland, which could cause all kinds of anger and problems.
Between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Look,
exactly.
October 31st is coming. Are there steps being taken to prepare for it?
They say there are, and they say they've worked on them. But even government reports, which they say are old, government reports show all kinds of potential problems in terms of keeping the economy running smoothly and keeping trade running really smoothly. So there's a lot of anxiety here. You know, people have been doing a bit of stockpiling. People are anxious about it, and it's the unknown. You know, the United Kingdom would be leaving this enormous market of more than 500 million consumers in Europe, and it would be done very, very suddenly, just cutting it off like that. So people don't know what to expect, and they're anxious.
What does this mean for the U.S. and U.S. consumers? Anything?
I don't think it's going to affect them at all. I think people are more concerned as they look at the global economy. Every time you have this uncertainty, these disruptions, especially given the U.S.-China trade war, it just makes people anxious and less willing to invest.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Frank, thank you.
You're very welcome, Robin.
So, Britain closer to Brexit. Back here in the States, Hurricane Dorian bearing down on Florida. Stay right here for continuing NPR coverage. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.